Hello, and a warm welcome to the Reform Party podcast. I am an atheist and a rationalist, so it's unsurprising that I might not want my speech or actions constrained by the writings of some sky fairy prophet from the 7th century. But I'm also a libertarian, so I wouldn't want to stop others from believing in what they wish. But Angela Rayner is going much farther. She wants to criminalise anyone who opposes any of the tenets of the religion of Islam and have the law punish them. Her tactic to achieve this is first to hijack a word to describe such behaviour and then to define what it means. And of course, once there's a definition, there'll be a law to follow which will criminalise saying anything that could be considered Islamophobic. This will either be a new standalone law, or more likely, Islamic belief and practice will be added to the list of protected characteristics in the Equality Act. The word Islamophobia was first used in a report by the Runnymede Trust in 1998, and there's a strong suggestion that the more widespread use of the word was encouraged by the Muslim Brotherhood. Their agenda was to try to give Muslims the same victim status as they perceived Jews had enjoyed via the term anti-Semitism. And of course, it's a very clever word. It literally translates as an irrational fear of Islam. So just by using the word, you imply that by opposing Islam, you must be irrational. And whether your fear of Muslims is irrational or not, you've not got off to a good start in any debate. I would say that fear of Muslims is sometimes rational and sometimes not. It depends on the circumstances. For example, it could be seen as particularly rational if you're travelling on the London Underground or going to a pop concert. So the Labour Party, Islamophobia and a troubling question. When does an alleged fight against hatred turn into a threat to free expression? And are we quietly importing a 21st century version of the blasphemy law, not through Parliament, but through following the template of the Labour Party rules and internal policy? Let's start with the facts. In recent years, the Labour Party, like many institutions in Britain, has faced mounting pressure to define and tackle Islamophobia. Accusations of anti-Muslim sentiment in political discourse, targeted abuse and structural discrimination have made headlines. In response, Labour has convened a working group to come up with its own definition. The group is chaired by the wettest of all the wet Tory MPs from the last government, Dominic Grieve KC. The stated aim is to produce a definition intended to recognise, identify and root out anti-Muslim prejudice. But this is where things get tricky. The definition Labour backed was closely aligned with the one proposed by the All-Party Parliamentary Group on British Muslims. It defines Islamophobia as a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness. That's the key phrase, expressions of Muslimness. Now, depending on how that's interpreted, it's potentially very broad. It moves beyond protecting people from discrimination and into the territory of shielding religious ideas, or at least expressions of a religious identity, from criticism. This isn't just theory. Since the adoption of this definition in the party, several members have faced disciplinary action, not for expressing anti-Muslim bigotry, but for challenging aspects of Islamic practice or ideology. Some were accused of Islamophobia for criticising the burqa or for voicing concern over gender segregation in certain community events. Others raised issues around the treatment of ex-Muslims or dissenters within Muslim-majority spaces and found themselves under investigation. This raises the question, will Labour's definition of Islamophobia effectively function as a blasphemy law? And here's what we mean by that. Blasphemy laws in their traditional form prohibit criticism or irreverence toward religious doctrines. They exist to protect faith, not just believers, but belief systems themselves from scrutiny. And in secular democracies, they're widely seen as incompatible with freedom of expression. Labour's policy doesn't explicitly criminalise dissent, but in practice, it seems to create an environment where criticism of Islamic beliefs or of conservative Islamic practices can be treated as inherently bigoted, even when expressed in good faith or in defence of liberal values. So what happens when dissent becomes taboo? When critiquing religion, one religion in particular, becomes politically risky? There's an irony here. The left historically has championed the right to challenge authority, whether it's the monarchy, the state, or organised religion. Labour in particular has roots in secularism and free thought. Yet now, some argue, the party is enforcing a form of ideological orthodoxy, one that prioritises sensitivity over scrutiny. But protection must be balanced with liberty. A policy that shields individuals from harm is one thing. A policy that shields ideologies from criticism is quite another. When Labour disciplines its own members for voicing concerns about religious conservatism or for standing up for the rights of ex-Muslims, women or LGBT people within Muslim communities, we're no longer talking about fighting racism, we are talking about suppressing legitimate debate. And when that suppression is framed as anti-racism, it becomes even harder to question. You don't want to be accused of bigotry, do you? You don't want to be seen as punching down. But here's the paradox. Refusing to debate controversial ideas out of fear of offending religious communities can itself become a form of paternalism, or worse, of moral cowardice. So where does this leave us? Labour's intentions may be honourable, but if the outcome is a chilling effect on speech, especially around religion, we have to ask, are we still in the business of politics, or are we in the business of heresy hunting?
So, why don't I like Islam? In some of these, my criticisms are not just of Islam, but of the cultures which the Islamic doctrine foments. For example, let's take arranged marriages. Particularly in its traditional forms, these often prioritise family interest over individual freedom, cultural preservation over emotional compatibility, and social control over personal happiness. It may not always be forced, but it is systemically coercive, gender-biased, and ethically outdated, in a world where we increasingly recognise the fundamental right of every person to choose their own path, including whom they love and whom they marry. At its core, it is anti-individual. And while defenders of arranged marriage often stress that it is not forced, in reality, the line is often fuzzy. There's emotional pressure from family. Expectations of obedience and fear of dishonour can make refusal extremely difficult, especially for women. Consent under pressure is not real consent. The absence of overt violence does not mean a decision is freely made. A 19-year-old told she will bring shame if she refuses a proposed match isn't making a free choice. She's being cornered. At its core, arranged marriage treats marriage as a family arrangement, not a personal union. Parents make the decision. Suitability is judged by status, reputation, family background, not emotional compatibility or shared values. This promotes marriage as duty, not desire. As a result, many individuals may enter life-altering unions with people they barely know, let alone love. Usually, individuals have no meaningful opportunity to say no, only yes to a limited selection presented by others. Arranged marriage often reinforces patriarchal power structures. Young women are expected to conform to cultural ideals of obedience, modesty, and sacrifice, not to seek romantic agency. In many traditional contexts, girls are married off earlier than boys, with fewer opportunities to delay or question the process. In some communities, arranged marriage is used to control female sexuality, prevent interfaith or intercaste relationships, and maintain the family's social standing. This reduces women to vessels of honour, not full moral agents. Love, affection, and chemistry are often expected to grow after the wedding, if at all. Yet divorce rates and dissatisfaction are not necessarily lower in arranged marriages, and when they are, it's often because leaving is stigmatised, not because the marriages are happier. Emotional mismatch, loneliness, or marital boredom are brushed aside as secondary concerns. In cultures that normalise arranged marriage, people often marry too young and with too little life experience. They're not encouraged to date, explore, or understand themselves before choosing a partner. They may never learn to identify red flags, navigate intimacy, or build relationships on their own terms. This creates adults dependent on family approval rather than confident in their own judgment. Even if one technically has a choice, opting out often comes with serious personal costs, social ostracism, guilt, and accusations of selfishness. Rejecting arranged marriage can mean losing your family, your community, your support network. And if the arranged marriage is to a cousin, it is even more problematic. The most consistently cited concern with cousin marriage is elevated genetic risk to offspring. First cousins share about 12.5% of their DNA. This significantly raises the chance that both carry a same harmful recessive gene mutation. If so, their children have a 25% chance of expressing that disorder. Studies in populations where cousin marriage is common, such as parts of Pakistan, the Middle East, and North Africa, have found higher rates of congenital heart defects, metabolic disorders, genetic syndromes, and infant mortality. In the UK, some local authorities have reported a disproportionate burden on the NHS due to these preventable genetic conditions. In Bradford, where cousin marriage is culturally common, officials have raised the issue as a public health concern. But cousin marriage is often used to preserve wealth, property or power within extended families. This can reinforce nepotism and tribalism, weakening broader social cohesion and meritocracy. It's part of the clan mentality, and this has been a major factor in the rape gangs scandal. Endogamy reduces genetic, cultural and ideological diversity. It entrenches insularity and reduces the flow of new ideas and external relationships. Many nations ban cousin marriage outright, including much of the US, about half the states, China and South Korea. The bans are often justified on public health and moral grounds. In some cases, cousin marriage is used to facilitate transnational marriages that bypass immigration restrictions. This can increase the risk of marriage fraud, forced marriage and lack of assimilation for new arrivals. Now, to be fair, not all cousin marriages result in harm. Many such couples have healthy children, and genetic screening can mitigate risks. For some, it's tied to cultural identity, but none of these override, in my view, the empirical evidence of higher risk or the need to protect the most vulnerable, children born into these unions, from preventable suffering. I don't like Sharia law. Sharia is religious law derived from the Islamic scripture, the Quran and Hadith, and interpreted by scholars through various schools of jurisprudence. In liberal democracies, law is meant to be universal, not faith-based, debated openly, not derived from divine authority, changed by elected legislatures, not by clerics or theologians. Sharia claims moral infallibility from God. Democratic law assumes human fallibility and welcomes reform. These two systems are fundamentally in tension. Sharia undermines equal rights, especially for women and minorities. In classical Sharia, a woman's testimony in court is worth half of that of a man. Inheritance laws give sons twice the share of daughters. Apostasy, leaving Islam, and blasphemy are punishable, sometimes by death. LGBT relationships are criminalized and punished with lashes, exile, or execution. Non-Muslims have fewer rights under Islamic governance. These principles violate modern conceptions of human rights, including gender equality, freedom of belief, and equal protection under the law. It opens the door to parallel legal systems. In countries like the UK and Canada, Sharia councils have emerged offering mediation on family and personal matters. But these bodies often operate without proper legal oversight, may pressure women into unwanted outcomes in divorce, custody or inheritance, create legal confusion, especially when Sharia-based rulings contradict the civil law of the state. The long-term risk is the development of legal enclaves where religious norms override state law, eroding legal unity and national sovereignty. Also, Sharia is not monolithic, but it's arbitrarily enforced. Interpretations vary between Sunni and Shia Islam and even within each sect. Which version of Sharia would be applied? Other aspects of Islam I don't like are the way it treats women. It teaches that men are the maintainers of women and that women should be obedient to men. Women are seen as objects or property that can be used by men. Islam also teaches that men may beat their wives in certain situations. Keen observation of the religion unveils numerous other troubling aspects as well. These are not stereotypes or rumours meant to denigrate Muslim people, they are the facts of a religion. It's worth noting that Islam is not the only religion whose holy book advocates social practices that are seen today as monstrous. The Bible, for example, is filled with conflicting messages and troubling outdated laws. However, the laws written in the Quran are considered to be the exact words of Allah, placing them beyond all criticism. These laws are considered to be as timeless and valid today as they were when the words were first put to paper. Therefore, it's more difficult for Islam to grow and adapt the way that some other religions have attempted to do. I don't like cruelty to animals, and we have even changed our law to allow it. In the UK, animals slaughtered for kosher and halal meat can be exempt from pre-slaughter stunning, but this exemption is a point of contention due to animal welfare concerns. While UK law generally requires stunning to minimise suffering, religious slaughter practices of Jewish and Muslim communities are permitted to be performed without it. This exception allows for kosher slaughter, which involves cutting the animal's throat without prior stunning. So I thought I'd better make this podcast now, because if I wait until Angela Rayner's new Islamophobia law is up and running, it may be that I wouldn't be able to make it in the future. And of course, I suppose there's a possibility that she'll decide to apply the law retrospectively, in which case I'm here. Come on, come and get me and lock me up.